Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Hello, and welcome to part two of Son of Sam on You Solved a Mystery. I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra. And if we sound exactly the same, it's because we're twins.
So we're going to get right into it today, because we have a lot to cover. So, on Unsolved Mysteries, the Son of Sam segment was actually under Unexplained Death. I thought it'd be something like mystery or conspiracy, but it was Unexplained Death. It originally aired as a two-parter. First part was November 2nd, 1988, and the second part aired November 9th. And on YouTube, it's been worked into Season 1, Episode 6, and Episode 7. If you want to make this a fun drinking game, I recommend taking a sip anytime I say corroborated or corroborating or substantiated or unsubstantiated or any form of those two words. And content warning for talk of sexual assault against children and death by suicide. I won't be going into any details, but it will come up a lot throughout this episode.
You challenged me to a drinking game, and then you give me content warnings, and I'm already in the closet and I don't have a drink.
We'll get through this together. In 1976 through 1977, the .44 caliber killer, later and better known as Son of Sam, left 6 young people dead and 7 injured before being caught because of a parking ticket. David Berkowitz confessed in detail to all of the attacks after being arrested. But one man didn't buy the story of the lone gunman. Maury Terry was a former reporter working for IBM at the time of Berkowitz's arrest. Something about Berkowitz didn't sit right with him. He felt Berkowitz didn't match the composite sketches. Tommy Zeno was 19 years old when he witnessed the shooting of Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante. He was parked with a date a few cars ahead of theirs, and he happened to glance in the rearview mirror just in time to see a man run up to their car, drop into a shooting stance, and fire. Tommy recalled how he, quote, blew them away in less than 4 seconds, end quote. Maury Terry went to speak with Tommy. Tommy told him that he had seen someone standing in the park who had long hair, but he couldn't really see the face. The individual looked like he was in good shape. The individual approached Robert's car like he was going to get in, then got into a stance, shot, and ran. Tommy told Unsolved Mysteries that he couldn't imagine Berkowitz, who was a little heavyset, running like that. He said, quote, in a week he can't get that fat, end quote, which is pretty fucking fatphobic. Also, I'm probably going to swear a lot today.
It's interesting that you should say fatphobic, because I actually took some notes and I have this section labeled fatphobia.
Great minds!
So, with Zeno in particular, like you said, his saying that someone who looked like Berkowitz, who did describe himself as a chubby behemoth,
good point.
Couldn't possibly have committed the crime that he saw. But, like, immediately I'm getting into how faulty memory can be, especially in a high-stress situation, a situation where you're scared. I wonder if there's, like, a combination of fat phobia that's altering his memory. Also, maybe some challenge to his manliness, like thinking that somebody who looked like Berkowitz didn't look like he should be threatening could have made him fear for his life.
That's interesting. That's really interesting.
Also, we're jumping right into one of the issues that I had with the episodes of Unsolved Mysteries here. Because if you watch the reenactments where they're showing David Berkowitz use somebody with a heavier build, the reenactments that are showing the crimes occurring use somebody athletic.
Wow. That's so interesting. I didn't notice that.
So I feel like Unsolved Mysteries was straight up going for this conspiracy theory, accepting it, and biasing its viewers.
Wow. That was a really good observation. Yeah, I also think Unsolved Mysteries didn't do itself a favor by not bringing on anybody who doubted the theory. They really only had people who were at least somewhat convinced of it. So, do I want to say right up at the top, maybe not Unsolved Mysteries' best work? Probably not, but that's how I feel about it. So Tommy also recalled seeing a yellow VW bug that drove past the park more than once. He told Unsolved Mysteries, Quote, "I didn't think it was him then, and I don't think it's him now." End quote. While being dropped off at home by a friend, Cecilia Davis had seen Berkowitz take a citation off his car. He watched the cops as they ticketed a few more cars, then tossed his in the back seat. He pulled out of his parking spot and honked at Cecilia's friend to move. She gave him what should be a world-famous dirty look before he drove away behind the police car. Terry didn't think that the Son of Sam killer would honk and follow a police car if he'd just shot people. But that's not when the shooting happened. The shooting happened later that night.
Oh, snap.
He says he wouldn't be so obvious if he was, quote, the elusive, ingenious Son of Sam, end quote. Nobody's calling Son of Sam a genius.
Yeah, I was thinking that as well. If you look at his letters, sometimes there's a depth to them, but tortured people can be artists.
Yeah, and he is very well spoken in interviews. I'm not saying he's not smart, but he's also not an evil genius. He just got real lucky.
He's not a criminal mastermind. He's someone who was pretty clearly delusional at one point in his life. And he's got those stream of consciousness rambling letters to go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving letters isn't smart, frankly. Just that alone.
I was listening to the Psychology in Seattle podcast while I was writing this, and they had an episode where they were talking about serial killers, which they don't usually do. It's more about general psychology, but occasionally they'll do something about true crime-ish stuff. And I can't remember his name, but the host said that smart psychopaths don't kill people because they know it doesn't pay. So, not an evil genius. After being dropped off, Cecilia took her dog, Snowball, for a walk. At 2:33 a.m., she arrived back outside her home. She saw Berkowitz, the same man who had honked at her friend, again, walking straight towards her. She said approximately 1 minute after getting in, she heard what she thought was a car backfiring. In retrospect, she realized that what she'd heard were gunshots. Her home was 2 blocks from where Stacy and Robert were shot. After testing it, Terry believed it would take at least 2 minutes and 30 seconds to speed walk from Cecilia's home to where Stacy and Robert were parked. And I have to say, they're putting a lot of faith in about a minute. If you unlock the door, you go inside, you take the leash off the dog, you go and grab a coffee and sit down, it could easily have been 2 to 3 minutes.
Yeah, at this point, I was still feeling very skeptical of Maury Terry's evidence.
Can I just say, I went into this with an open mind. I did. I really did. But I can't believe people would put so much weight on something so vague, but that winds up being a theme. So,
here we go.
Witnesses near the area said they saw a man in a light wig run and jump into a yellow Volkswagen Bug driven by another man and speed away. They drove away with their lights off and nearly got in a collision.
Did that happen after a shooting?
Yes.
Could it possibly have been someone heard a shooting and tried to get into their friend's car more quickly?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I would run away. Joseph Basteri, a retired NYPD homicide detective interviewed for the segment, felt that only 2 of the composite sketches really resembled Berkowitz. Although he did find that strange, he understood that these composites were developed by witnesses and victims who saw the killer for about 3 seconds and don't get to the sketch until hours and sometimes days, so they're not always accurate. Although Berkowitz provided a detailed confession, Terry felt that the confession was too easy. He suspected there was more to it, a greater plot than one man. Terry believed the two in the bug and Berkowitz were involved. In fact, he believed that they were members of an organized conspiracy, a satanic cult, for which Berkowitz had been chosen as the fall guy, not willingly, but because he knew he was responsible for getting the parking ticket that gave them away.
This is one of those places where I was like, this guy makes a lot of claims, because he says that Berkowitz was the unwilling fall guy. How does he know? Who did he speak to know that Berkowitz was unwilling? Because Berkowitz confessed.
Another great question.
It's specifically the fact that Maury Terry says that Berkowitz was the unwilling fall guy that bothers me the most. Because this is just a claim that cannot be supported.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've never heard from anybody else in this cult to tell us that Berkowitz did not choose to be the fall guy.
You're reading my mind. We will get into it. Terry proposed that the real killer had escaped in the yellow VW because he was deemed more valuable to the conspirators than Berkowitz. He said of Berkowitz being the sole shooter, quote, "The facts and evidence, not speculation, the facts and the evidence say otherwise," end quote.
Show me these facts and evidence.
He heard about the demon dog story and the Carr family, and he looked them up in the phone book. He saw the name, John Wheat Carr, and wondered, could this be the John Wheaties from the second letter? He observed that the second letter referenced King Wicker. Berkowitz lived near Wicker Street. John Santucci, the Queens County District Attorney, learned that someone who had supposedly spoken to Berkowitz said Berkowitz admitted that there were more people involved. In light of the questions, namely, how did Berkowitz get 2 blocks in what was reportedly only 1 minute, Santucci moved the case from inactive to active. Terry posited that the symbol Son of Sam used to sign the second letter was satanic. He believed that the cult in which Berkowitz was a part sent the letters and planned the attacks. He said in the segment that he learned that John Wheaties referred to John Carr as if he wasn't the one who had decided that, and that he was nicknamed Wheaty after his sister? Named Wheat Carr?
Wait, his sister's name was Wheat Carr?
Mm-hmm.
That's a heck of a name.
Mm-hmm. It's a very wholesome name, Wheat. But conveniently, this nickname was known to few people.
Yeah, probably only the other cult members.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That only talked to Terry and never talked to anybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Terry found confirmation of his theory about John Carr when he noticed that one of the composite sketches bore similarities to a picture of John, which I gave you. There were actually 2 that people say look like him. And like, yeah, but...
And I believe I expressed last week that anybody making claims off of these composite sketches is going to be distrustful to me.
Uh-huh. And that picture of him is so washed out.
Are there any other pictures of John Carr?
Not that I can find.
Just as I can sort of see David Berkowitz in some of the composites, if I look at them hard enough, I can kind of see some of John Carr in this very generic-looking mm-hmm. composite.
It's very generic. Yeah, I think that the heavy-handedness in the coloring of the hair, so that it's all black, has a really big impact in terms of making it look like him, because he's got that shiny black hair.
He's also got short eyes. I'm not sure exactly how to describe that. You know, his eyes
they're not are wide. Thin. They're kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this particular composite has fairly hooded eyes. But then, like, the rest of the face, the ears are totally wrong and the chin is totally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Based on this poorly lit photograph, the nose is wrong. Mm-hmm. So it...
Just like with Berkowitz, there's so much that's wrong.
It's shenanigans.
Yeah. Terry concluded that Berkowitz, John, and John's brother Michael Carr were in the satanic cult, evidenced by the fact that John and Michael Carr were literal sons of Sam. Sam being Sam Carr.
And all Sams out there better stop having kids.
Mm-hmm. Terry tried to find John Carr, tracking him to Minot, North Dakota, where he had been stationed by the Air Force. Although he lived in Minot, John had occasionally commuted to New York, where his family lived, during the time of the attacks. According to Lieutenant Terry Gardiner of the Minot Police, John Carr was addicted to drugs, hung out with people who got in trouble a lot, and had talked about his friend Berkey months before Berkowitz was arrested.
And they were former neighbors.
Mm-hmm. 6 months after the arrest, John was found dead in a friend's apartment. Apparently, he had died by suicide. Lieutenant Gardner stated that on the night of John's death, his girlfriend said that it must have been suicide, but the next day, she was reported as saying that he had to have been murdered. She supposedly said that he was afraid, He was wanted in New York for the Son of Sam killings and feared for his life. He also called her his live-in girlfriend, which I find odd because his girlfriend was married and wasn't going to leave her husband for him. Terry reported that interviews with friends and police in North Dakota indicated John was heavily involved in a satanic cult in North Dakota and New York. The cult activities included drinking blood and urine, ritual sacrifice of animals, especially German shepherds, and, quote, all sorts of horrible activities certain satanic cults get into, end quote.
From all of the research into the existing satanic cults that have been observed and written about, because mm-hmm. that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert, it's not a thing.
The segment explains how an acquaintance, Phil Falcon, told Minot PD he had accidentally walked in on John and a friend performing a satanic ritual, sacrificing an animal, in Falcon's house, and that he was in a violent cult. Terry also reported finding the same symbol Berkowitz used to sign his letter on the back of a phone book in Minot.
Where is it now?
It's a good question. Only 18 months after John's death by suicide, in 1979 at 4 a.m., his brother Michael Carr was killed in a single car crash.
I just gotta say, they must have been pretty bad Satanists.
Yeah, where was their eternal life?
Where were all their rewards for their evil deeds?
Michael was speeding and lost control of his car, crashing into a post. They show a picture of the car in the segment, and it was totally destroyed. So awful. Years later, prison sources who knew Berkowitz told Terry that Berkowitz claimed he was introduced to the cult by Michael Carr in 1975 when he was invited to a, quote, floating coven party. Can I go to a floating coven party? Sounds like a blast. Count me in. Terry hypothesized that the cult was the 22 disciples of hell mentioned in the second letter and that they orchestrated the Carr's deaths. As if it's supposed to be a shocking revelation, in a deposition, Berkowitz responded affirmatively that he knew John Carr.
Unsolved Mysteries presents the relationship to the Carrs as some kind of gotcha, but everybody who's paying attention already knows that there is a history there because it was their dog
mm-hmm.
that he said was possessed and telling him to do evil things.
Mm-hmm. They were neighbors.
This is just a known fact, so I don't understand why they're trying to be like, aha!
In another 1982 deposition, Berkowitz was asked if the Carr brothers were in a satanic cult, and he responded yes. He was asked if they were both killed to ensure silence, and again, he responded yes.
How much had he spoken to Maury Terry at this point?
I'll just say, he had. Terry also came to believe that this satanic cult was the group that held rituals in Untermeyer Park in Yonkers, 1 mile from Berkowitz's apartment. After hearing about his theory, a 15-year-old boy had called Terry to ask if he knew there was a satanic cult meeting at Untermeyer Park and killing dogs. Terry met him there, and the boy showed him where the cult was thought to be meeting, an old building filled with, quote, satanic graffiti. Terry calls it, quote, very sophisticated graffiti, while they're showing a crappy pentagram in black spray paint. And he pointed out where the dogs had been found. In August of 1977, two boys had led the police to bodies of three German shepherds in Untermeyer Park. Two had been strangled with chains, one shot in the head, reportedly.
Which is disgusting animal abuse,
yeah.
But there are a lot of reasons, a lot of horrible reasons that people kill dogs.
Yeah. Unfortunately. They also say that 10 other slaughtered dogs had been found around the park. In what time frame? Conveniently unspecified.
Rather than speculating about Satanism, I'd like them to look into the dog fighting in that area.
Yeah, that's a good point. Retired Captain Gerald Buckout of the Greenberg Police Department told Unsolved Mysteries that he received info that people in black robes had been seen chanting and doing rituals at an aqueduct near the back of the park.
An adequate paper.
Mm-hmm. Terry now had proof that there was a satanic cult, knew where they met, and could tie it directly to Son of Sam and the letters.
So where are the pictures? Where's the documentation of this cult existing?
Yeah. How he drew these conclusions, I still don't fucking know. And I watched the entirety of Sons of Sam.
Another one of those claims he made, where I just gave a lot of side eye, was when he said that the cult in the park tied right to, he said, tied right to the Son of Sam murders.
Yeah.
Never did it explain how. They just want us to take this on faith.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I have no faith in this.
Santucci explained to Unsolved Mysteries that he felt that the overriding concern was that if there was someone out there who would continue to kill, the public deserved to know. Unsolved Mysteries reported that even at the time of the filming, cult activity had continued in Untermeyer Park. Two locals who remained anonymous said that they'd seen a car drive by the aqueduct path, which I guess was odd. So they went to investigate and saw 15 to 30 people chanting, with one person clearly the head of the group chanting loudest, and they decided to get out of there as fast as possible before being seen.
You know what the only example I can think of that sounds anything like what they were describing?
What?
The Ku Klux Klan.
Oh my gosh. Just you wait. Because you're on the same wavelength as a FBI special agent.
Cool.
I'll tell you about it.
The other thing with those cousins, though, is that I can totally picture it being like with you in the dark on a camping trip or something, and we hear something up ahead, but we need to get to the bathroom that's, you know, a couple campsites away from the tent. And so by the time we get to the bathroom or back to the tent, we're positive we were being pursued by a bear.
Or axe murderer.
You're just like, you're laughing and you're getting more and more tense.
Uh-huh.
And then you get in your tent and you cling to your flashlight and wrap your sleeping bag tight around you as if it'll keep you safe.
Or you go scrambling back to your house and lock the door behind you and go, dude, that was crazy.
And then tell everybody that you saw a cult because it'll get you attention.
With the help of the broadcast, Santucci hoped to identify the subjects of three of the composites and find the owners of the 1971 yellow Volkswagen Bug with a license plate ending in G-U-R or G-V-R. Because, if Terry was correct, there was still an active cult out there. Satanic panic grew from a conglomeration of events starting all the way back in the 60s, when the Manson family murdered 7 people in 2 nights, leaving words written in blood on the walls. The trials were highly publicized, and the world learned of Manson's heinous helter-skelter race war and his use of symbolism. The same year, occultist Anton LaVey published the Satanic Bible, which became the primary text of the Church of Satan, which he founded in 1966. In 1971, The Exorcist, claiming to be a true story, was published and 2 years later became the iconic movie. Rock groups like Led Zeppelin influenced counterculture teenagers and allegedly hid demonic messages in their records. The Zodiac and Alphabet Killer used cryptic symbols in their murders. Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer committed atrocious, bloody murders against children and young adults. In 1978, the horrific Jonestown Massacre reinforced the notion of violent cults. Cults, violence, and demons were on the brain, and people began conflating the three. And let's not forget the Son of Sam's contributions. Demons, the devil, more young people being slain? Author Jonathan Mahler wrote in his book, quote, "The frenzied media coverage fanned the growing sense of fear. The growing sense of fear fanned the frenzied coverage," end quote. Meanwhile, there was a rise in the double-income family model due to the women's movement in the 70s and 2 recessions in the 80s. Daycares were a quickly growing demand, and parents were having to entrust other adults to care for their children. Stranger Danger also has roots back to the 60s in the UK, when Ian Brady and Mira Hindley sadistically murdered 5 children, and it migrated to the US in the 80s and 90s when the 24-hour news cycle created round-the-clock access to sensational stories of kidnapping, sexual abuse, and murder. Also in the 80s, there were the milk carton kids, the Tylenol murders, the creation of poisoned Halloween candy myth, and the first wave of scary clown sightings. The gothic subculture came to America, confusing parents across the nation. Teenagers wore black, heavy metal blasted out of boomboxes, and the media was there to broadcast the dangers these deviant interests posed to your children. Nothing was safe from the Satanic Panic. The Smurfs, Dungeons & Dragons, and the toothpaste company Procter & Gamble were all representatives of the occult, secretly spreading its message of evil. If you look at the second picture I sent you, that's the Procter & Gamble logo at the time.
It is a half moon with a face in profile, got heavy eyebrows, and the hair is tall and the beard is long and makes up the crescent. In front of it are some stars, and it looks like it could be turned into a woodcut pretty easy because it's got these horizontal lines that create both darkness and light in the center.
So what people noticed about that was that it had 13 stars, which represented the original 13 colonies of the United States. But 13 is also an evil number, I guess. And if you look at the curlicues in his hair and beard, they make sixes. So that's 666.
Do they, though?
Finally, if you get real creative, you can connect the stars so that they're three sixes. And if you observe the end of the beard and the top of the hair, they're obviously Satan's horns.
Okay, look, I like to think I'm a creative person, and I could turn maybe one of these groups of stars into a six, but this is more shenanigans.
It's shenanigans. In 1962, pediatric radiologist Henry Kemp published a highly influential article called The Battered Child Syndrome. Do you remember that from the Shepherd episode?
Yeah.
The article explained the ways abuse can negatively impact a child's entire life and changed the way the public and medical professionals thought about child abuse. Over time, the term battered child syndrome became maltreatment. The visibility of the article led to a growing public condemnation of child abuse. In 1974, Congress passed the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act.
And this all sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, it was. People just take things too far sometimes. People were waking up to the reality that child abuse, including sexual abuse, happened and had to be addressed. Couple this with the message being pushed by the media that modern music and subcultures were coming for your children, and the air was ripe for hysteria. And then, in 1980, a discredited memoir called Michelle Remembers was published. Its authors were Canadian Michelle Smith and her psychologist, Lawrence Padzer. Michelle had been happily married, but sought help for depression after a miscarriage. Padzer used regression therapy in the sessions and claimed to have regressed Michelle to her childhood and recovered lost memories. In those sessions, Michelle supposedly uncovered memories from when she was five of being sexually abused by her mother and a satanic cult that forced her to participate in satanic rituals. In the book, the pair claimed that she was tortured, kept in cages with snakes, drenched in the blood of infants, witness to human and animal sacrifices, and forced to participate in a nonstop 81-day ritual. It concluded with a ritual that summoned Satan himself, but Jesus, Mary, and the Archangel Michael intervened and removed the scars from Michelle's body and hid her memories until the time was right.
Okay, wait. I was following, not believing, since you already told me it was discredited, but following that she had had all of these memories implanted. And she's working with a psychologist, and so they're working with the physical and the memory, and then, what, angels?
Thanks, Jesus, Mary, and Michael. Popped in to save the day.
So this psychologist published that angels healed his patient.
Regression hypnosis is a highly controversial technique whose validity has been widely called into question by members of the mental health community. Michelle's father denied all of the accusations against his wife, who had died in 1964. Michelle's two sisters, who were suspiciously absent from the book, also rejected the story. Also suspicious was the fact that Michelle and Pazder never took the allegations to the police, and the story mirrored modern pop culture. When people started looking into that 81-day ritual, there was no interruption to her schooling that allowed for such a lengthy absence. She also described a car crash that never happened. Some felt that Michelle wanted to be near Pazder and implied she fabricated the stories to spend more time with him. Both were married at the time Michelle started her quote-unquote treatment, but after publishing the book, they divorced their spouses and married, which is super unethical and gross.
They really created a strong bond over some make-believe.
And a lot of money, because Michelle Remembers was a bestseller. Michelle was invited to be on Oprah along with Laurel Rose Wilson, who also wrote a book about experiencing satanic ritual abuse called Satan's Underground. Her true background and identity was uncovered by Writers for a Christian magazine, and her books were pulled by her publisher.
Writers for a Christian magazine disproved a claim about Satanism?
Mm-hmm.
Way to go, Writers for that magazine.
In 1999, she adopted the identity Laura Grabowski and published a book about her experience as a Holocaust survivor.
Oh, good grief.
She collected $1,000 from donations for Holocaust survivors.
Can you sink any lower?
Laura was born in Washington State, USA, in 1941. Needless to say, she was not a Holocaust survivor, nor a victim of satanic abuse. The visibility of these books and stories on Oprah, Geraldo, and 2020 fanned the flames of moral hysteria into the blaze of the satanic panic. And Padzer had conveniently positioned himself as a premier expert on the phenomenon he created. Padzer was a devout Catholic who thought Satanism was turning people away from God. So I think he had two motivations: church and money. But the book had devastating real-world impacts. There are so many examples of how satanic ritual abuse, another term for satanic panic, accusations, devastated lives. So I'm just going to go through a few of them. One of the earliest cases was in 1980 in Kern County, California, where several social workers who had attended a seminar that used Michelle Remembers as its course material were told about an occult sex ring by two young girls. Their step-grandmother, Marianne Barber, had coached them to make the accusation. Barber was mad that the older girl had been molested, which is totally fair. The girl's parents, Alvin and Debbie McQuan, put her in counseling. Barber had a history of paranoia and delusions. She was so enraged that she reported the McQuans to social services. A social worker checked it out and deemed them fit parents. But in a bid to gain custody, Barber filed charges of child endangerment. She then had an episode of psychosis that was so bad that it required hospitalization, but when she was released, she was given custody of the girls.
What?
I don't understand it. She coached the girls to say that they had been physically and sexually abused, including being hung by ceiling hooks and used for child pornography, and instructed them to accuse 12 people of being in a satanic sex ring, including members of the McQuan family, friends Scott and Brendan Niffin, and Linda Phelps, the social worker who had deemed the McQuans safe parents. After many grueling and coercive interviews, one of the Niffin's sons also said that he had been abused. Charges were brought against the McQuans and Niffins, and each was sentenced to 240 years in prison. In 1996, the children recanted their testimony, and all four parents were released from prison with their convictions vacated.
And their lives completely ruined. Absolutely devastated.
They spent 14 years in prison. In New Jersey, in 1985, a comment by a little boy to a nurse led to 51 children at We Care Nursery being interrogated, many of whom described experiencing imaginative forms of sexual abuse. There was no way the teacher could have abused the children without being seen. And the allegations included sticking children with knives, which would have left marks that were conspicuously absent. Still, the teacher was charged with 235 counts of abuse and went to prison. Psychologists who examined the case found that the children were interviewed in a leading and suggestive way that could lead to memory errors and implant false memories. They also used anatomically correct dolls, so while the experts at trial testified that the children were familiar with sex acts beyond their years, it's totally possible that the kids pointed somewhere on the dolls and said something noncommittal, and the interviewers used their bias to fill in the rest. After 5 years, the teacher was released and her sentence overturned. The New Jersey Supreme Court ruled, quote, "The interviews of the children were highly improper and utilized coercive and unduly suggestive methods," end quote.
I feel like those interviews probably screwed those kids up more than anything else.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. The things that they were forced to come up with seem traumatizing.
And if that's not enough, they have to carry with them through their lives that they went through this absurd thing. I mean, some of them might be too young to remember, I hope, for their sake. But still, they just have to know for the rest of their lives if they do remember that they were involved in this incredibly unjust and coercive thing.
In 1984, in Massachusetts, the owner of Fells Acre Daycare Center and her children were accused of ritual abuse. Most of the evidence came from videotape sessions where the children told the interviewer that nothing had happened to them, but she rejected their objections until they'd been coerced into conforming to her view of events.
On video?
Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant.
The family was tried and convicted. The owner of Fells Acres died before there could be resolution. Her daughter eventually chose to plead guilty just so she could receive time served and get out of prison, and the son was only released on probation in 2004. All the allegations from children were coming after hours of leading, suggestive, and biased interviews. There was no behavioral or physical evidence. Studies found that the kind of prolonged, repeated questioning being used frequently resulted in false reports. In 1989, in North Carolina, Little Rascals Daycare fell victim to coached allegations. Stories from the children included murder of babies, torture, and being thrown into a school of sharks. Seven employees were accused with satanic ritual abuse, and sentences varied from 7 years to life in prison. All of them were overturned. In 1992, Texas, Dan and Frances Keller were sentenced to 48 years in prison. The charges were that they had dismembered infants, dug up corpses that they made children carry from the cemetery, and served the children Kool-Aid mixed with human blood.
And here's another instance where I have to ask, where are the bodies?
Can you check the cemetery? Is anybody missing? They were released in 2013, after serving more than 20 years in prison, when the expert doctor who won the conviction recanted his testimony.
That person needs some kind of accountability.
Yeah, I wonder if there was any. The best-known case of satanic ritual abuse allegations is the McMartin Preschool in California. The ordeal began in 1983 when a little boy had painful bowel movements and his mother accused her estranged husband and a teacher at the school named Ray of abusing him. She also said they had sexual encounters with animals. The police arrested Ray and sent a letter to 200 parents saying that an employee had been arrested on accusations of abuse and asked parents to consult their own children if they had been abused.
Arrested him based on what? Kids get constipated. Did they have anything other than the fact that a kid was constipated?
The mother's insistence. The letter proceeded to detail all the different types of sexual abuse the children might have suffered. Shockingly, parents panicked. Hundreds of children were interviewed by an unlicensed therapist, once again using leading tactics and anatomically correct dolls that invited children to pretend or speculate about possible events. By 1984, McMartin's staff was being charged with 321 counts of child abuse involving 48 children. A clinical psychologist analyzed the tapes of the interviews and found that the methods used were, what do you think, coercive, and forced the children to repeat back a script that they were being fed by the interviewer. The adults did the majority of the speaking in the interviews, and the children initially denied that there had been any abuse. They only began to spin tales after hours of this coercive questioning. Children have creative and often dark minds, and they want to make adults happy. Allegations from the children included labyrinthine underground tunnels with secret rooms for rituals, traveling on a hot air balloon, children being flushed down toilets, a goat man, animal sacrifices, abuse that left no physical trace, the ritual sacrifice of a baby, and Ray turning into a witch and flying away with his coven.
Oh my goodness.
One child, when shown a lineup of photographs, identified Chuck Norris as one of the abusers.
Oh, snap, it goes all the way to the top. The fact that you included hot air balloons makes me just have to share this thing that I've been thinking of this whole time, because there's so much about memory in this case, in Maury Terry's theories, It relies very heavily on people's memories being very accurate. So speaking of hot air balloons, there was a study where people were shown doctored images of themselves in a hot air balloon.
Hmm.
And over time, they actually came to believe they had flown in a hot air balloon as a child.
Whoa.
And the same study was done without photos, just telling somebody a story, just telling somebody that they had been through something. And eventually, the people who were being told the story started filling in details.
Wow. That's wild. That's exactly what was happening.
Wow. It's just in general, it's an example of how people are very suggestive, and also the memory is just very prone to errors.
Mm-hmm.
Parents started digging under the McMartin School, looking for the tunnels, and even hired an archaeologist to assess the ground. The building was demolished in 1990. There was no labyrinth. The trial was also a mess. The mother who made the accusations was schizophrenic and sadly passed away from complications from alcoholism in 1986 before the trials were complete. The mother had told the prosecution about her diagnosis ahead of time, but they spun the illness as coming from the stress of the allegations. She was honest with them. They spun it. Her illness was withheld from the defense for 3 years, and even then they didn't receive the full information about how bizarre her allegations were. They received a doctored transcript. One prosecutor named Glenn Stevens actually resigned from the case in protest and accused other prosecutors of withholding evidence, including that Ray was never identified by the suspected victim and that the deputy district attorney withheld exonerating evidence. For the trial, the prosecution had 7 medical expert witnesses, but to shorten the time, the defense only got 1, making it look like they had less evidence.
That's ridiculous.
After the first trial, all of the allegations were acquitted except for Ray's. For him, the jury was hung. A second trial ended the same way. And at that point, the prosecutors decided to not seek a conviction and just drop the charges.
If someone is actually a Satan worshiper abusing children, you don't just drop the charges.
Yeah. Ray had served 5 years in prison before the case collapsed. The case lasted 8 years, received no convictions, and cost $15 million. It remains the most expensive criminal case in American history.
Wow.
Could have put all that money into child welfare programs, but... Some children recanted their allegations as adults, saying they'd lied because they wanted the questioning to end.
That totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, I didn't want to sit in a stuffy room and have an adult ask me questions over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as an adult, I don't want that to happen either.
So there are 2 points of irony in all of this. One is that the fervor around satanic ritual abuse made it harder to identify and prosecute genuine cases of child abuse during a time that abuse was still viewed with skepticism. The second is that the rallying cry of the believers of satanic ritual abuse became, believe the children, the very thing they weren't doing. And I can't move on without mentioning the West Memphis Three, one of the most significant cases of satanic panic. In 1994, 3 Arkansas teenagers were convicted of murders that prosecutors portrayed as satanic sacrifice. The only evidence was their perceived gothic lifestyles. They had been labeled bad children. They were freed in 2011 after almost 20 years in prison, and whoever did brutally murder 3 little boys is still out there. The most dangerous thing about the era of satanic panic was the satanic panic itself. In 1981, Special Agent Kenneth Lanning was assigned to the Behavioral Science Unit at the FBI Academy in Quantico. He specialized in studying all aspects of sexual victimization in children. His unit was frequently contacted by professionals who needed assistance dealing with different, unusual, or bizarre violent crimes. He started hearing about satanic and occult activities connected with allegations of child abuse in 1983 and 1984, and at first he believed them. He had seen all kinds of bizarre and horrific things. The idea that there could be a satanic cult hurting children wasn't out of the realm of possibility. He took the allegations extremely seriously. But as the number of cases began to grow and grow, he started questioning how hundreds, if not thousands, of people could truly be secretly meeting and victimizing so many children without getting caught. In 1992, he published a report rejecting the existence of satanic cults. He explained in the first pages, because he knew the kind of people he was going to reach, that he had no reason to lie. Some people had already accused him of being a Satanist who infiltrated the FBI to facilitate a cover-up of satanic rituals. He said, quote, "One officer wanted me investigated by Congress. Perhaps most upset were those law enforcement officers who were making money and getting status as experts in the area." End quote.
The most absurd and infuriating argument that people make to try to discredit others is that they're part of the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Just, if you're not with me, you're against me.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts my brain.
At the time, Lanning had dedicated 11 years of his professional life to researching, training, and consulting in the area of child abuse. He wouldn't benefit from ritual abuse being real or not, and his findings were in the best interest of victims of child abuse. He said, quote, "Society's attitude about child sexual abuse and exploitation can be summed up in one word, denial," end quote. But with greater access to news sources and the 24-hour news cycle, stories about child abuse were daily occurrences, and it was becoming difficult to pretend that it didn't happen.
Well, it must have been so much easier for people to believe that it was evil, satanic cults rather than, like, the uncle.
That's exactly what he said. He said society struggles with the idea of an abuser that's not completely evil and a victim that's not completely good. Like what he calls a, quote, "child prostitute," end quote, but who we know today are victims of abuse. And though he didn't have the language for it at the time, he agreed. He said, quote, "When adults and children have sex, the child is always the victim," end quote. But in a survey by the Los Angeles Times at the time, only 37% of the responders thought that forcing child into sex work was child abuse. 37%.
Ew.
Ugh. Lanning was actually pretty current in a lot of his thinking. He promoted teaching children about consent and bodily autonomy and understood the complicated emotions children have when they feel like they have to protect their abuser or feel guilty because they didn't save themselves from the abuse. Through the 70s, society began to reckon with the reality that most children were abused by someone they know, most often a male. But in the 80s, society started leaning back to stranger danger, a return to something more simple. Black or white, good or evil. Satanic cults were the modern stranger danger. Satanic ritual abusers were snatching 50,000 kids a year. The idea of "the devil made me do it" made it easier to contend with child abuse. It wasn't the abuser's fault, it was a demon acting through them. But in 1990, data showed that the estimated number of child abductions was between 200 and 300 a year, not 50,000. Lanning realized that law enforcement trainings regarding cults presented information based on a mixture of fact, theory, opinion, fantasy, and paranoia, and because some of it could be corroborated, the implication was that it was all true and documented, which it wasn't.
That's a heck of a mixture.
You want to hear about a mixture?
I sure do want to hear about a mixture, Athena.
The idea of Satanism included and conflated the Church of Satan, witchcraft, the occult, paganism, Santeria, voodoo, Freemasons, Nazis, Scientology, Rajneesh, New Age, astrology, Buddhism, Hinduism, Mormonism, Islam. You can see how this mishmash was malformed. Santeria, witchcraft, and voodoo are not Satanism, nor are the others. Because Satanism was so poorly defined, supposed satanic ritual abuse was too. He also asked, and I really enjoyed this, if we want to label something satanic abuse, shouldn't we label crimes committed by other religions Protestant abuse, Catholic abuse, Jewish abuse? Quote, "Are the atrocities of Jim Jones in Guana Christian crimes?" End quote. Just like Christians interpret the Bible differently, one Satanist committing a crime would not mean that all Satanists shared their belief. As he heard more and more allegations of satanic ritual abuse, he noticed that they involved unsubstantiated allegations that were difficult to either prove or disprove, and that many of them don't seem to have ever occurred or even be possible. Some impossible allegations were that a victim was cut up and put back together, that an offender was a vampire, and that an offender took a building apart and then rebuilt it. The likelihood of human sacrifice or cannibalism was extremely unlikely, as none of the supposed human sacrifices have ever been found. There was also no physical evidence that a murder ever took place at the supposed locations Satanists were holding rituals. There was also no evidence of a satanic cult ever existing. The idea that thousands of people, including politicians and law enforcement and respected members of the community, were practicing Satanists who were regularly murdering people and leaving no evidence just isn't believable. Another zinger, and to your point, he states that the closest documented example of the type of activity alleged by believers in satanic cults is actually the Ku Klux Klan, which ironically and deliciously used Christianity, not Satanism, to rationalize their racist violence. Over the years, Lanning became more and more concerned about the lack of physical evidence and inability to corroborate the claims. He considered that the cults could just be very clever. He knew that one cunning individual might be able to get away with a well-planned crime, but bringing even one partner into a crime drops the odds of getting away with it considerably. So imagine having a cult, a little horse, a little baby horse. But imagine having a whole cult of people, like 15 to 50 people. It's just not believable.
Eventually, you get to somebody who's not good at keeping their mouth shut.
Yeah, exactly. Lanning suggested a number of reasonable explanations for accusations of satanic ritual abuse. Distortions, trauma, normal childhood fears and fantasy, misperception, overzealous interviews, urban legends, and the possibility that an offender used elements of Satanism as a way to control their victim. And most likely it was a combination of all of the above. The fanaticism around satanic ritual abuse came from a combination of the emotional issue of child abuse and the emotional issue of people's religious beliefs. If a law enforcement officer believes that all crime is evil and all evil comes from Satan, then all crime is satanic crime. But Lanning states that interests in D&D, heavy metal, Satanism, and the occult are all part of a normal adolescent development, and most teenagers involved don't commit serious crimes. The ones who do commit crimes usually come from dysfunctional families. Substance abuse, economic inequality, and systems that punish troubled children are greater indicators of future crime than an affinity for pentagrams and black candles.
Which are both actually symbols of protection and banishment.
Yeah.
Of what ails you.
Mm-hmm. Another gem. He theorized that Satanists probably have the same problem with teenagers rebelling against their belief system that other parents do.
I don't want to go to church, Mom. I believe in God.
He said in kind of a sassy way that when it comes to protecting children, conversations about substance abuse treatment and reforming the juvenile justice system are more valuable than fear of satanic cults.
I feel like that's pretty factual.
Yeah. Lanning also chided law enforcement for focusing more on graffiti than searching for evidence. He said, quote, "It is not the job of law enforcement to prevent Satanists from engaging in non-criminal teaching, rituals, or other activities," end quote. Fucking freedom of religion. Lanning felt that the best way to investigate child abuse and protect children was to minimize their satanic concerns and instead focus on evidence. Really listen to the children, is what he advised. Think critically and look for the truth. He emphasized that children and other victims involved in satanic ritual abuse are probably not intentionally lying, but are reporting maybe distorted memories or something that they have come to believe. Lanning perceived potential consequences of satanic panic that concerned him more than the fantasy of satanic cults. One was that it could perpetrate the idea that victims lie and reignite doubts of the existence of abuse. He was also afraid that in all of the hullabaloo, actual instances of abuse got lost. It's not just common sense to focus on evidence that can be corroborated, it's essential, because even if only a portion of an allegation is true, corroborating evidence could reveal the crime. In conclusion, without any evidence, he felt that the public shouldn't be scared into believing that babies are being bred and eaten, 50,000 children a year are being murdered as human sacrifices, or that Satanists are taking over daycare centers. He called for more work to be done by mental health professionals to understand why victims allege things that didn't happen, how children's memories are formed and influenced, and that happened. There was more research put into it. Until then, we risk the guilty going free, the innocent being imprisoned, and the reality of child abuse being overshadowed by fantasy. In 1994, researchers with the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect found that out of 12,000 accusations of satanic ritual abuse, investigators could not substantiate a single one. The Church of Satan was founded in 1966 by Anton LaVey, who wrote the Satanic Bible in 1967. According to their website, Satan represents pride, liberty, and individualism. The Church of Satan rejects the idea that people should suppress their desires, instead embracing what they call man's true nature, a carnal beast, quote, living in a cosmos that is indifferent to our existence, end quote. Satanists believe humans created all gods, so instead of worshiping a work of fiction, members of the Church of Satan place themselves in the center of their universe and are, in a sense, their own deity who can deliver love and wrath on those they feel deserve it. Of course, satanic practices vary across individuals and regions, as all religions do. Some Satanists believe in magic in the form of ritual with candles and herbs that create a true magical effect. Others believe in magic as an intention sent out into the world. And others are more scholarly and grounded in science. Besides the Satanic Bible, the Church of Satan follows 9 satanic statements, 9 satanic sins, and 11 satanic rules of the earth, which includes 3 key points. Number 5, do not make sexual advances unless you are given the mating signal.
Yeah, that wording is a little ugh.
Number 9 is do not harm little children. And number 10, do not kill non-human animals unless you are attacked or for your food. In a fact page for youth who are curious about Satanism, they write, quote, unlike many religions and philosophies, Satanism respects and exalts life. Children and animals are the purest expressions of that life force, and as such are held sacred and precious in the eyes of the Satanist. Besides, it is very unsatanic to take any creature's life against its will. End quote. So you can probably see what I'm getting at. Since its inception, it has been unsatanic to harm children or animals. Robes? Herbs? Candles? Chanting? Sitting alone in your room with your curtains drawn, listening to dark metal while you think about Satan's relationship to freedom? Sure. The Church of Satan should not be confused with the Satanic Temple. The Satanic Temple was founded in 2012 by Lucian Greaves and Malcolm Jerry as a way to spotlight religious hypocrisy in the U.S. They consider themselves to be a religion and have tax exemption, but they are also a non-theistic political organization that follows the idea that undue suffering is bad and reducing suffering is good. As stated on their website, the mission of the Satanic Temple is to encourage benevolence and empathy, reject tyrannical authority, advocate practical common sense, oppose injustice, and undertake noble pursuits. They don't believe in the supernatural, they're non-theistic, and Satan is purely a symbol for critical thinking, curiosity, a quest for knowledge, and beliefs that change with the best scientific understanding. That kind of thing. They follow 7 tenets, the 7th being, every tenet is a guiding principle designed to inspire nobility in action and thought. The spirit of compassion, wisdom, and justice should always prevail over the written or spoken word. Compassion, wisdom, and justice are incongruous with child abuse and animal sacrifice. That's me. That's not them, that's me. The Satanic Temple is often criticized for their satirical, over-the-top, sometimes comical actions, which are often intended to offend. For example, after the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, the Westboro Baptist Church planned to picket the funerals of the victims to spread their homophobic message. So in response, the Satanic Temple organized a pink mass at the grave of Westboro Baptist Church founder Fred Phelps' mother. The goal was to perform a ritual that would make Phelps think that they had turned her gay in the afterlife. There's a picture of women drenched in pink liquid kissing over her headstone. They said it was, quote, the Mormon practice of baptizing the dead, only much gayer, end quote. They advocate for bodily autonomy, protecting mentally ill people from harmful practices like memory regression, separation of church and state, and a friend told me that people are joining the Satanic Temple for abortion access because it's protected as a religious right.
Oh, snap.
Their antics often wind up putting the Church of Satan in a bad light, because I think it's fair to say that most people don't know the two are different. The Church of Satan actually rejects the Satanic Temple as a religion. They hold that it's a purely satirical endeavor co-founded by a filmmaker to create subject matter to document. They also consider them hypocritical, despite saying that they're not Satanists in the way that the Church of Satan members are. They co-opted Church of Satan symbology and tweaked it just enough to avoid lawsuits. And I think that is pretty hypocritical considering the Satanic Temple sued Netflix for using a statue of Baphomet similar to theirs in Sabrina, but maybe we just disagree on what constitutes a noble pursuit. But for our purpose, the most important takeaways from both are their focus on respect for life, self-actualization, autonomy, and personal responsibility. Neither religion allows for sexual assault, animal sacrifices, or child abuse. There are religions around the world that include animal sacrifice, but to conflate them with Satanism or judge them for their practices is ethnocentric and often racist. The end.
Every culture kills animals.
Yeah.
Hey there, Athena here. So while we were recording, we realized that we were just under halfway done with the notes and already had an hour-long episode, so we decided to cut it there and call this Son of Sam Part 2.1, and next week we'll be releasing Son of Sam Part 2.2. Also, we're experiencing some slight technical difficulties, so if I sound a little bit worse than usual, that would be why. You can connect with us on Instagram at YouSolvedAMystery. You can email us at YouSolvedAMystery@gmail.com. If you'd leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, that's always great. And maybe share us with a friend. As always, I'm Athena. As always, Chandra is Chandra. Join us next time for You Solved a Mystery.